So we're continuing our discussion on Sri Harinam Chintamani, and today we're looking at chapter 9 and chapter 10. Sinning on the strength of the holy name and instructing the glories of the holy name to the faithless. First, I'd like to ask you a question. What is the difference between a sin and an offense? We understand that there are things that are sinful, and it's not always so easy in Kali Yuga now, even for people to fully understand what is sinful, because many people do not understand that there is a Godhead, that there are absolute ways of how that Samon Bonam is arranging his universe, how he is interacting in his creations, and what he is requesting of others. And so once we minimize or try to annihilate the fact that there is a God, then it becomes easier to engage in what is called situational ethics, where people consider something is right because it seems to be logical, it seems to be rational, it seems to be functional based on the environment and the times. And so many people, this is how they live their lives now. And they feel that others who think differently are imposing on them, are unhealthy, unnatural, and even, fanatical. I think I shared with you once when I was visiting in the Michigan area at a university, and a young, rather conservative girl, seemingly, came to the teaching project to interview me on some contemporary topics. And then she shifted from one topic to the next, and then she started discussing homosexuality. She says, "What is your movement's opinion, and what is your opinion on homosexuality? How does your society see the gay movement, gay rights, etc.?" And I asked her, "What is your opinion?" And she very eloquently started explaining that she feels that people have right to their choices, that human nature is such that there are differences in human nature. We're individuals. We have civic rights. We have national rights. We have international rights. And it is not proper for someone to impose their standard of ethics, their idea, morality, their choices and preferences on another. She felt that people should have the opportunity and the right for exploration. And so as they try different things, they should find what fits for them. And when they find something that fits their psyche, then it should be honored and respected because it is something that person has chosen and who has the right to impose on an individual's choice, as long as it doesn't itself cause any threats to society. So she wasn't some type of radical young lady. She was typical college student, even somewhat seemingly conservative. And her views, in one perspective, were quite rational. But they were based on from down trying to look up, or was based from one considering that their own mind, consciousness, ideas, desires is the ultimate, and other people's desires, ideas are also ultimate for them, etc. So was not honoring the fact that there's higher law. And there are certain things that's relevant to the development and honoring of the soul, and certain things that are unhealthy in various ways. I mean, ultimately, as devotees, we understand that everyone's looking for love and affection and ultimately looking for the ruchi. And so there is the inherent desire for relationship, association, for affection. And we also take issue with the fact that illicit affairs, whether it's homogeneous or heterogeneous, is improper. So our major focus is on illicit activities are improper. And certain lifestyles will accommodate illicit activities more than others, and that's improper. Just as now in many countries, people don't marry so much anymore, especially in countries like Denmark and Sweden, a few places, it's less and less people officially marrying. It's becoming like archaic, old-fashioned. People live together and they just consider that they're partners. Or often now, you ask someone, this is your wife, your husband? That's my partner. Which basically means that this is the person I'm living with now, and we have an agreement, and that's okay. Because we both agreed on something. It's just people often feel if there's mutual consent about whatever, then what is wrong with it? If individuals who are mature adults are mutually accepting some conclusion based on what's happening in their life, what's wrong with it? And in one sense, what is wrong with it? The two people have agreed. They're not forcing and imposing on each other. They're honoring something that they both feel they want to align themselves with or on. Then why should other people have any disturbance with them? We're in a society where there is just individualism, a lack of sense of community, a lack of sense of unity, a lack of sense of the need to honor the Lord and higher laws, higher relationships. You take all of that away, then it's just based on people making choices for the moment. But even in the most basic materialistic situation, there are people who have that kind of mentality will be failures. Because even materially speaking, there's need for organization, need for institution, there's need for long-term plans, need for short-term plans, there's a need for vision, there's a need for being able to see how to carry out that vision. And with that vision, there's a need for teamship. No organization, doesn't matter, religious, educational, political, commercial, can work if each individual or each little group decides that they're going to do whatever they want and request that it be honored and accepted. How much can people be able to maintain a job if they just come to work and they decide, myself and my friend over there in the other cubicle, we want to do like this. And so other employers should honor this. How would society work if every street people decided that they're going to have their own laws? After all, this is the street that we live on, and so this we bought these houses, we're paying the mortgage, we're paying the taxes, so we make the decisions. It doesn't work that way. In education, people just decide, myself and two other friends, we want to get this degree, and we want to do this kind of study in this way, and we want to do it in 6 months' time instead of 3 years, 4 years, etc. It doesn't work that way. There is independence, yes, but there's also distinct guidance, criterion, laws that people are to honor, to be considered to be proper, and to honor if they're going to be certified and be achievers. But it's often amazing when it comes to higher things of life, philosophy, morality, religiosity, that there's a tendency to people simply want to be relative and do whatever they want for the moment. So this causes a lot of chaos, and it's a lot of cheating, because even in our day-to-day lives, we do not live that way. Just like the last few days we were looking at disobeying the orders of Guru, one of the offenses. And there may be many people who may feel this idea of mentorship, guruship, this is archaic, this is imposing, someone imposing on you, one giving up their power, giving up their freedom to be under some type of autocratic arrangement. But such people are also cheaters. Because in living in any society, there is authority, and there are restrictions, and there is punishment and chastisement for one who doesn't follow the rule of law. So everything we do, there is some sense of accountability that we're expected to be responsible for. You can't just drive down the street any way you want. You can't just decide, as a so-called good citizen, you're not going to pay taxes. You can't decide that you're going to do whatever you want to do in the public. I mean, from being in a house, walking out of a house, driving out of a house, anywhere we go, there is rules that we are expected to follow, and if we don't, there is consequence. And even just in our day-to-day activities, as we try to pursue certain things, we always find some way to connect with some type of authority, some type of consultant, legal advisors, medical advisors, financial advisors. That is such an integral part of existence. But then the mind is such a rascal, then when one thinks about or tries to enter into spiritual lifestyle, the mind says, why do you need someone to be accountable for giving you instructions? What is this? This is unnatural. And the mind wants to rebel. This is a cheating mentality. Because no one could be a good citizen, a good worker, a good employer, a good this, good that, unless one is ready to honor criterion, relationship, and some situations one is distinctly under specific and general authorities. But when it comes to the greatest sense of authority, to God, to Krishna, his representatives, then the mind wants to do something else. Wants to rebel. And often one feels some sense of exhilaration to just do whatever he or she wants, as they want. So, things that are done in society, often sins. But we see in spiritual life we're concerned with sins. But as we look deeper, we are concerned even more with offenses. So I ask you first, as we begin to look at some brief things that Haridasa Kaur is saying on these two topics, what is the difference between a sin and an offense? There are some subtle differences. They connect in some ways. Sometimes they seem almost to be synonymous, but there are some distinct differences. What is the difference?
In case of offense, it is your own principles which you accept and violate them. So there's a difference. The community does not come in the picture. The society does not come in the picture. So that's the difference.
Anyone else want to try to share something? Yes.
And offense is usually like a breach of etiquette that has been agreed upon by a certain group of people.
Vishnu?
A sin can be like doing the wrong action in some way, not according to scripture. An offense would mean having a mentality of wanting to somehow go against God's law.
All of these are correct, partially, at the same time, leaving some ambiguities. For instance, we know that you can offend in the mind, so that's a state of consciousness, and the mind is always affecting everything. We also know there is verbal offense and there is physical offense. So that is not total wholesome, because there is the improper activity in the mind and the proper activity that is carried out through words and through actions. In terms of an individual situation, that the sin affects the community and the offense doesn't. But we see that sometimes one can make an offense, that person can suffer, that person's family can suffer, the village can suffer, and sometimes it can go on for generations. Sometimes there can be such a heavy offense or apparat that it actually can even go on for generations. So that is, again, partial accurate, but not, because it does have an effect. And karma is such an unusual connection, is that sometimes we may be suffering because of some offense that was so great that it's affected an entire area. Just like when a pure devotee takes birth, the entire village, city, for miles and miles, Bodhisattva says, gets blessed. And such person is able to liberate many agents that are connected with them karmically. But also, the Shastra explains, such person is offended. The offense can be so serious that the whole family and even also the whole village can also suffer. Our Western sort of Judeo-Christian connection mainly focuses on sins, and there are different laws and commandments and tenets and codes and suryas that give what happens if somebody commits a sin and how it is looked at by God. So these things are quite similar in some ways, sin and offense. One is kind of connected with another, produces another. Sometimes the same word is used. But one of the major differences is that an offense is actually more serious. Because sometimes a sin can be done and just some general prayaschitta can remove one from the effects of that sin. Some general activity for reformation, something that is even sometimes done impersonally can free one from the sin. It says you can make a sin and you can just go to jail and do time and you're freed of it. You know, you break a law or whatever. Rob a bank, do this, do that. But the offense, it's not as so easily cleared. The offense, there must be a change of consciousness, and in many cases, one must go to the person who was offended and beg forgiveness before the one can be free of such. Some sins, one doesn't really have to personally appeal and present their case and beg for forgiveness for the cleansing and the transition to take place. Some sin, one can do something, someone in some environment, and then just pay a fine or pay time or something else, and then they can be considered freed. They have done the necessary thing. You break some law, etc. So what's important in this situation is that as we look at the offenses to the holy name, that when someone has what is called sometimes an accidental fall, or someone by circumstance, some extemporaneous things have happened, some lack of stability and the person finds himself overwhelmed, they deviate. This is sin. But now, when such person who has done such sin, now knowing that such things is improper, more aware of circumstances, and then continues. Just like someone is initiated devotee. And due to weakness of heart, weakness of sadhana, becoming overwhelmed, they do something deviant. They have compunction, they have regret. So they start to be more careful not to do the same thing again. And if there is sufficient sincerity, they will be able not to fall prey. But then, there are the cases where someone is taking shelter and they know something is improper. They have such a desire to do it. They do it. And then they try to do some extra rounds or some extra activity with the idea of freeing themselves of such. So this is sinning and making offense on the strength of chanting the holy name. And it is not forgiven in that way. That we do something and we decide, okay, I'm going to chant 10, 15 extra rounds. I'm going to do a fasting today because of this. But unless there is sufficient change of mentality, and if it was a sin towards someone, then there must be the humbling of oneself and begging for forgiveness with change of mentality. Otherwise, the effect still goes on with the person. So Haridas, of course, he shares some interesting things. We're reading from the Sri Harinam Chintamani. And Haridas, of course, is being used by Lord Chaitanya to explain the most phenomenal things about the efficacy, the potency, the power involved in chanting the holy names. So we've been discussing that this is how Lord Chaitanya used Rupa Goswami to explain so many powerful things in terms of the Ras Tattva. He spoke through him. Sarvabhauma was used to explain various things about liberation. And Ramananda Roya was being used in helping the world understand what are the higher goals of life and ultimately the position of the divine couple. So this is a phenomenon that happens in the Vaishnava alignment, is that sometimes one is so dear to the Lord, part of his eternal entourage, they descend with Krishna and his manifestations, and Krishna is doing and speaking, but also he is using and speaking through some of his unalloyed servants. So Haridas is totally in ecstasy and prema, grabbing Lord Chaitanya's feet, tears coming from the eyes, voice, body trembling, and voice in a static state, as he is being asked to do this and feeling so insignificant, but at the same time amazed how these things are coming through him. Like Sanatana Goswami was once saying like this, he doesn't know how, but these things are coming through him as the Lord is speaking through him in such ways. So we look at this particular chapter, chapter 9, sinning on the strength of chanting a holy name. Chanting gradually diminishes the propensity to sin and simultaneously purifies the consciousness. At this juncture, the taste for chanting begins to manifest and the inclination to commit sinful activities vanishes, though a faint residue of previous sinful activities still linger in the consciousness. So we stop the sinful activities sometimes, but some of the desire for the sin still remains in the consciousness. Or some of the seed that can later grow and turn into the weed again, or turn into the actual sinful action, is still there. So as Vaishnavas, it is our duty to go and look closer to see how to stop the sin. And then we have to work more on our consciousness so that we have less and less desire for the sinful things. Otherwise, in time, the desire will produce the unhealthy action. Just like when first someone is smoking, drinking, doing different things, sinful things, gambling. And so they're thinking about stopping, but it's so difficult. Then finally they stop the action. But the desire is still so strong. And so especially when they become weakened or bewildered or disturbed, then they will not have the strength to not engage in the sinful action. But as they have become more aware, the mind and intellect has become more accepting why this thing is very unhealthy, why they should avoid it, why it's so bad for them, to reflect more and more how they've been enslaved by such. Then they're developing more of the inner and mental strength that can help to balance them from falling prey to such. Now, especially when they're able to use some of that same emotional, psychophysical energy, and they're able to direct it towards something healthy, then when the desire, and then after the action is stopped, then there becomes less and less inner desire for such, because those that mind culture is going reposing in something else. But this is the connection of Param Dastanavadate, that we must engage in transformation. We can't just try to stop something. Repression, it won't work after a while. We can do things without a taste. We can repress and repress. But unless we are sufficiently understanding and also finding ways to resolve or to redirect that energy, then you will find constantly that Maya will just grab you and beat you and let you go for a while and beat you some more and come back in another way, because one is still allowing themselves to be receptive to Maya's enticement. Like somebody is calling on you to come in to do something. They want you to go someplace with them, do some things. And so if you are idle or if you are bored, then you may entertain the idea. Why not? But if you have plans, activities, and things that is part of your structured life, things, plans, and things that you have to do, then someone else suggesting something that may not be so good for you because you're not inactive, then there's less chance that you will consider, maybe I'll try it. And so, as the trite statement, the mind that is not occupied is the devil's advocate. So, what can happen then is that as soon as that energy is not being sufficiently used, it's got to go someplace. We're all pleasure seekers. We want happiness, we want pleasure, we want satisfaction. And if we are not finding it, because we're not allowing our intellect to understand what is devotional service and why we do certain things, and if we're not finding some things that we can put our energies into, this is sadhana bhakti, we are to enjoy and employ our senses. So if that is not happening, especially with the mind understanding and accepting, then as we do such things mechanically, as we do such things without sufficient mental culture, we are just repressing and we're acting in a mechanical way, and at some point we will lose it. And all these inner desires will just surface and resurface, and they will haunt us, and they will beat us, and they will enslave us. So, where there is a sin, something is done wrong, then there must be also an awareness of why it's not to be done, and a genuine desire to be freed of such. Otherwise, many times people are very disturbed when something improper happens in their life, but they're disturbed because others have found out about it. Materialists and spiritualists. Sometimes a devotee is very disturbed about some deviation that they've done. But they're disturbed because others have found out about it. So they're not really so much disturbed that they did something improper. They're disturbed that they are not perceived in the same way. Or they're disturbed because the ego has been bothered. They're disturbed that others are not going to honor them, respect them. And so what they're really disturbed is that their facade has been somewhat uncovered. So such a person will not grow sufficiently. They will not make a shift in consciousness. And they will either later continue a similar sin with hopes that this time nobody will catch them, or they will do other types of sins because the mind, the consciousness is not in the right place. So this is similarly with the chanting, is that we can do something improper, but if we're not changing consciousness and also going deeper to look at what is the weed or the seed that is there that can surface and be nourished from time to time, then it's like cutting off the top of the weed, but the root is still there. And then as the rain comes and the sun, and then that weed begins to grow. So there are people who have become initiated in the process of devotion. They follow for a while, they deviate, they commit sin, they commit aparads on the strength of chanting the holy name. And so they carry constant negative karma associated with that because they haven't deeply felt a sense of remorse. They just feel bad. They just feel dismal. They feel morbid, existential. But they haven't really, really changed in seeing what this sin is doing and how this is a disturbance to what they have, the contract they've made. And we'll see later what it means to their connection with their guru, etc. So then Haridas says, the receding sinful reaction leaves an odor of sinful habit hanging in the air. It's like you're cooking something, you're burning incense, and so it leaves an odor in the air. So he's saying that this sinful action that's done, it leaves some residue, some effects, some fallout in the air. But the chanters, contact with the name engenders a purity of willpower and mind that can overcome this clinging stigma of sin. Perchance, a devotee may commit a sin. Still, he does not have to undertake the penance or prayaschitta recommended in the Vedas to atone for, to counteract it. Such sins are a passing phase. They can be drowned. In other words, he's saying that one could even commit a sin and not even have to undergo heavy ritualistic things or arrangements to be freed from such. But if they go on with the process, then the benefits and the potency of the process will absorb and eradicate the sin. Now he says something different. However, if a devotee commits another sin on the strength of chanting, then he is unsteady. He is a deceitful person, and is doomed due to his nama aparad. So first it's a sin, inattention, lack of recognizing what the dangers are, some unhealthy association, some unfortunate mood shift has come, and the person has become a deviant. But now the person continues, and now he becomes aparad. He is a deceitful person, and is doomed to his aparad, nama aparad. Sin happens in two ways, due to sudden weakness or mistake. That's one category. And the other category is premeditation. There is a vast difference in the two. Like there's a difference in different types of murder. Someone kills a person, and there was an argument, there was passion, and it happened on the spur of the moment, extemporaneously. Someone kills a person and there is some emergency, something happens, there's self-defense. They've been assaulted, they've been attacked. But in another case, someone kills someone, they plan it, they know it's wrong, they think it out, and they execute it. They know something is sinful, they're desiring it, they're thinking about it, they plan it, and they execute it. That is much worse. And here, Haridas is saying, such person is a deceitful person, and the effects of that aparat will destroy the devotional creeper. A materialist has to perform prayaschitta and repent bitterly if he commits sin. But if he commits sin on the purifying strength of the holy name, then even prayaschitta is futile. He faces certain ruination. Even after untold retribution in hell, he will not be resolved from this. Even when he has to go, he says, to Yamaraj, who has to go to the heavenly planets, and he will encounter some suffering, still that will not free him. Just the inclination to sin itself results in enough tribulation for the soul. If he further compounds the difficulty by deliberately committing sin on the strength of chanting, his fate is most lamentable. See, knowledge is dangerous. And Krishna consciousness is very dangerous because it's very powerful. So when someone gets to blessings of Krishna, that there are billions of people, just in this universe alone, what to say of so many other universes, and so few souls where Lord Caitanya has appeared and come into the planet. He only comes so often in world history, in planetary history. So Krishna comes, Lord Caitanya comes. Someone gets a chance to hear beyond religion, beyond ethics. They begin to understand that there is actually a spiritual world where there is spiritual variegatedness, there is activity, and one can have eternal or has an eternal relationship with the Lord. One then takes initiation into the Parampara process that is ultimately arranged by the Nitya Siddhas coming from the spiritual world. So now one is being given, getting a chance to be introduced to their eternal sanatana, eternal position in terms of what their rupa is, what their lila, their guna, nama, and to associate eternally with Krishna. Someone gets all of that as an opportunity and now chooses to be sinful. Therefore, much is given, much is expected. So therefore, to come so close and to be such a deviant, there is heavy consequence. Just like there is heavier consequences if you are a bhakti or a bhakti and you make a sin. There's heavier consequences if you are first initiated, heavier if you're second, heavier if you renounce. And so, as we are giving more shelter, more blessings, then more is expected from us. Otherwise, it becomes a greater assault of denying the Lord's mercy. So someone is chanting the holy name. They've taken initiation and they've pledged. Every day, they are reflecting on the offenses. And in spite of that, they choose to make a sin. And so, there's heavy consequences of such that it says even going to the hellish planets does not totally free one. Such person has to be able somehow to have a serious shift of consciousness and beg forgiveness before they are able to be freed. Anybody explains how some persons, a devotee who has taken shelter of the holy name, can live in any situation, in household life or in the forest as a hermit. If the household situation is conducive to chanting, then the life of a mendicant is unnecessary and wrong. In other words, chanting is so powerful and it can align one so wonderfully that one doesn't have to be so much concerned about what varna, what ashram that they're in. Even if they are steeped in household affairs, no problem, as long as they go on chanting and able to maintain their focus. Then, Saridas is saying, they should not even then consider renounced life because it is not even necessary. If household life is unfavorable, the devotee is duty-bound to forsake home. It is a terrible offense to commit sin on the strength of chanting. This offender is forever banished from the path of devotional service. See, this, the process works, and the reason that people have trouble in devotional service is always related to the sins and the aparads. And the sins and the aparads are related to individual desires, present and past. And the desires are related to how we take advantage or do not take advantage of association. So last in this chapter, he presents remedies for the aparads. If by some error this offense, this nama aparad, is committed, one must search out the assembly of pure Vaishnavas. Propensity to sin is like a highway robber who accosts the wayfarer. The pure devotees are the guardians on the path who come to one's aid when the devotee calls out loud for help. Just hearing that call, the robber immediately runs away, fearing the guards will come. The guardian, the pure devotees, pure Vaishnavas will console the devotee with soothing words and assurance of their protection. In other words, he's saying first and most important, such person who's become involved in sinful activities, and now they become aparats, has weakened their devotional creeper, become bewildered, has become bored with the process that can help them, that the help is that they must purely understand the danger that they're in. They must take more advantage of the assembly or association with Vaishnavas, and they must take shelter of such Vaishnavas, or such sadhus, who by them now changing their conscience, they're trying to take shelter, that in itself will chase away the robber or the fallout of or the residue of the sin. It will alter the desire, alter the environment that the soul is having to work through, and therefore one will be given certain strengths to move on. But how does a person do that when a person is so distracted by their deviations, when a person is so faithless about the medicine that can help them? How does a person change when the person is so much preoccupied with trying to pursue the deviations? Well, in such case, the individual will be doomed unless somehow that desire changes by them being able to realize why they want to get help and take genuine help. It's like someone who is a drug addict, and they have a little notion about being free of the drug. But at the same time, their desire for that stimulation is so strong, even though they commit themselves to some kind of therapy, some kind of rehab, that they don't really follow through. So they do it for a while, then they go back and take the drug, they leave the halfway house, they leave the drug clinic, and then they come back. And people do that every few months, every few years. But what is going on, Nalayani, wake her up. You're sleeping. What is going on is that they really don't have a genuine desire to change. They have some basic notions that they should do differently. They see in general how their life is going down. They see in general how they become like an animal for the drug. But still, they really don't have a profound desire to change. And so, no institution, no books, no therapists, no workshops is going to change that person unless he or she really wants to try to change. Then, along with that desire and the help, the change comes about. So sometimes, some devotees stay in Maya or they're in Bogotiaga back and forth because they really, in their deeper aspect of their conscience, don't really want to change. And so Maya keeps producing opportunities for them of why they should stop. There's not a deep enough appreciation of what they are associating with, not a deep enough appreciation of what wonderful opportunity they have if they just somehow can follow through in this lifetime. So because of that, then the sin aggregates and it even turns into aparat. And then it becomes delicate because it's not just an ordinary sin. Because now somebody is sinning who is in knowledge and who has made certain vows and certain commitments. And so it becomes more great. Now the last chapter we're reading for today helps us to understand a little bit more why this is so grave and so important, so powerful, but also so dangerous. Because when the disciple, aspiring disciple, is thinking about connecting for initiation, taking order of guru, disciple must watch very closely to be sure that they're comfortable with receiving instructions from a particular spiritual mentor. And also the mentor must analyze and evaluate the chela, the disciple, to see if in fact he is in a position and ready to take responsibility for that particular person. Now we will see that not only is that the case, but if there is deviance on either side, there must be rejection because it is a very serious affair. We look at now instructing the glories of the holy name to the faithless. The first essential requirement for chanting Krishna's holy name is Shraddha, or firm faith. One who is bereft of it cannot hear the name and is therefore unfit to chant. According to Vaishnava etiquette, a person who does not have Shraddha for the name should not be initiated into chanting. If a faithless person is initiated into chanting or is instructed about the glories of the holy name, he will defile and disrespect the name. This is the statement of the scriptures. The swine will crush the pearls thrown before it, and the monkey will tear the cloth it is given. A faithless person will similarly commit increasing offenses to the holy name and thus invite his doom. Simultaneously, the initiating guru will be dragged down by his share in these offenses. Very soon, he will leave the path of devotional service. Now, let's try to understand this. Sometimes, a spiritual mentor is somehow caught up in making disciples. Disciples can produce prestige, wealth, influence, money, so many things. Sometimes one is thinking more of building up a workforce, an army, a financial base, or whatever. This is, of course, cheating type of mentality on the behalf of a spiritual master, so-called spiritual master. So now, when one does such, one then will even give initiation to practically anyone steps forth, even though the person doesn't have sufficient faith. Or one will even solicit someone to be my disciple. This person is wealthy. This person has power. They want to have that person as a disciple to use that person in some utilitarian way. If such person is given the holy name, inducted into the process, then what happens is that that person, not having sufficient faith, becomes an apparati to the holy name. The individual will suffer because now they're not only making sin, they're making apparat. And the guru will also suffer because he is responsible for taking, giving guidance and giving shelter to such soul, and he has brought in a person who is a hypocrite. He is being hypocritical or counterfeit, and it says they both will go to hell. So one must be very careful in just giving diksha initiation, just thinking that somebody is coming forth, and let's give them a chance. At the same time, the duty of the spiritual masters are to be merciful. Now, they are to focus on how they see they can be merciful and at the same time be careful. You'll find some spiritual masters, they will not give initiation for 3, 4, 5 years. Some spiritual masters, they will not give initiation until you've taken many tests, until you've gotten recommended in many different ways, until you've been directly under them, etc. And some don't give initiation, only to a few who they know they can personally monitor. They're going to be personally around to be able to monitor, and therefore they will take a handful or a small number and rest the case and such. Some spiritual masters will consider someone, sometimes 2 or 3 years, and then let them know that you're not my disciple. I'm not going to deal with you. That is their prerogative. And it is in the spirit of being careful. Now, when someone is very open and is ready to accept almost anyone to give them a chance, that is dangerous. It is an aspect of mercy, but it is dangerous. And it is as dangerous according to the adhikari or the spiritual potency of the particular spiritual master. If one doesn't have sufficient potency, then even a few such cases can bring one down. And even if one does have very high potency, still there will be some suffering that incurs based on bringing in people who are deviant, who don't really have real faith, or who later become deviant. Now, we see Prabhupada's mood was very liberal. And many of the acharyas, many of our spiritual masters are very liberal. That is mercy, but that is also dangerous. And so therefore, it becomes very important that the disciple has better understanding of what they're committing to, the guru has understanding, and there is warning, there is mercy, but also there is points when one has to be cut off, when a disciple is so deviant that the guru says, now that is enough. Like a father says, you're no son of mine. The love is still there. The concern is still there. The son has become so deviant, the father is letting the son know, your deviation is so heavy, I can't stand to see it. It hurts me so much to see what you're doing. So if you're going to do like that, then you do it somewhere else. Let's don't be in contact. I consider you no longer my son, which means the father is in such pain that he has to do like that. He's hoping that maybe this will bring some sanity to the son or to the daughter. So there are times that the guru has to formally cut off the connection with hopes that maybe now there will be some change. And if not, then Haridas Kaur says, if one doesn't do, then the guru also can gradually become doomed with the deviant disciple. So basically in Kali Yuga it's warned that a spiritual master should not take unlimited disciples. And basically in Kali Yuga it is warned that one must be very careful, just as the disciple should be careful to make decision of someone he feels, I can take orders from this person, and the spiritual master is also to be careful in such ways. And the worst case is like Krishna, keeping everybody accountable. So he says, so you're a spiritual mentor, and you're just going to try to make disciples for name and fame, therefore you're going to pay consequence for it. You're going to give somebody initiation who does not even have sufficient faith in the process in the holy name. So this is an offense in giving the holy name, initiating the faithless. It makes devotional service cheap. It causes people to become confused because when they see such people who have taken so-called initiation acting improper, then it causes a disturbance to the culture of devotion because it sends out a message that this isn't so bad, that this is okay. And then you have other people who are a little bit on the borderline or weak taking to the same kind of lifestyle, thinking, well, after all, others are doing it. And then it becomes very confusing. If a guru knows that a person who has approached him for initiation is insincere, faithless, a pretender, yet he heedlessly initiates him simply for material gain, he commits himself a heinous offense against the holy name. The guru was unable to make a correct assessment, and thinking the disciple to be sincere and faithful gave him initiation, only to later discover that he is a pretender, he must make immediate redress for his mistake. In other words, there are times when the spiritual master, considering this person is a risk case, or the person seems to be okay, gives the person initiation. Later, that person turns out to be such a faithless deviator, then the guru is supposed now to make some redress. If he can't somehow change, elevate that person, then he has to either arrange for chastisement or for annihilation of the contract. Sometimes the spiritual master personally arranges for chastising the disciple. Sometimes problems that come to a disciple is engendered by the guru to try to help that person to be able to understand what is proper to act in the proper way, just like a father does or a mother. Sometimes the father and mother is giving distinct reinforcement based on good behavior. And sometimes the parent has to give some restrictions. You can't drive the car now for a week. You can't go out. Or sometimes the parent does some other type of activity for chastising the child with the hopes that it will deter the child from the deviant type of behavior. And so Papa says, so you forgive once, forgive twice, forgive three times, and then you chastise. If by inadvertence and lack of experience, a mistake such as instructing and initiating a faithless person occurs, the initiating spiritual master should be filled with fear and remorse. He has to publicize his offense before the Vaishnava community and reject the insincere disciple. In other words, that having such insincere disciples is such an attack on the own guru's spiritual immune system, such an attack on Vaishnava culture and community, that the guru, when having such deviance, may from time to time even expose in the public, in community, in assembly, as a way of having to eradicate some of the disease and the plague that comes along with such a deviant. And it's a way to send a message to others. This is improper activity. This will not be tolerated, so that the disease will not become like a cancer of such. He has to publicize his offense before the Vaishnava, that offense before the Vaishnava community, and reject the insincere disciple. I've been doing this for many, many years ago, and some people heard about it, they were kind of shocked. And then later this book came out, you'd understand why there are times when it's necessary to make it clear to the disciple that if you continue doing as you do, then you're no longer considered a disciple. My mood is I accept disciples rather easily, but also I reject disciples. And so if the guru fails to act properly, he gradually sinks into the depths of moral depravity or something, an illusion. And he disenfranchises from the path of devotion. And he'll be disenfranchised from the path of devotion. So, Lord Caitanya, your instructions to those who have ordained, you probably don't name them. Okay. So the point here is that when such sin takes place and it continues, it becomes a duty of the spiritual master to make it clear what is the standard and what is not the standard. Tolerance is there. Compassion is there. But compassion is not seeing your son or daughter take drugs and you smile at them. Compassion is not seeing your beloved take poison and you just consider, well, what can I do? Sometimes someone has a child and the child is taking drugs. And so by letting the child stay in the house, you are arranging facilitation so that child will keep on being so-called materially comfortable while they take their drugs. If you can't change the child's consciousness, you can't get them to get therapy, then why keep that child in a position where you are almost like reinforcing their deviation? And so similar, you can't get the disciple to change. You can't get them to take proper shelter of other sadhus, and they can't take shelter of you and guidance. Then what? And then by allowing them to think that they're okay and they go on, then this is reinforcing the sinful activity. And last thing, if without paying heed to your instruction, the guru initiates an insincere pretender, he commits a grievous offense for which he goes to hell. Now we can understand also why sometimes gurus fall. It has to do with, first, their own immune system. Second, has to do with their own relationship to their guru, because every guru is also a disciple. It has to do also with the quality and caliber of those who they're dealing with, who they're responsible for. You put all of those things together and it determines the status of the particular spiritual master. Where especially one is quite not having so much, say, internal spiritual strength, him or herself, and having deviant disciples, and having many deviant disciples, there will be physical problems, psychological problems, and spiritual problems. One will be physically attacked, physical body will be bothered, psychologically, emotionally, they'll be attacked, and if it continues, there will be spiritual deviation. So it becomes a very powerful connection. The guru is accountable, and the disciple is accountable. And they both should understand what their responsibilities are and try to see best how to carry out. The nama-aparadha committed by the charlatan disciple slowly but surely diminishes the guru's spiritual potency. Finally, the guru is ruined. This offense has a devastating effect on both the guru and disciple. They both must enter hell. You see so often when the guru falls, how many of those connected with him fall, that the contract has become very disturbed in such a way, and everybody suffers. And it's such an unfortunate thing when such things happen like that. And often it has to do with the disciples collectively as well as with the guru. It is never that when someone falls, we just say, well, he really had too many sinful disciples. No, that's not the case. Never did it be put fully on the disciples, because the guru is making the choices and the guru is supposed to become more and more prophylactic by taking shelter of his guru in the parampara system. And even by such, Krishna will not even hold the guru fully accountable for all of the deviations of the sinful disciples. or to the degree that guru is not having such potency, then one will be held accountable. One will have to be accountable to a certain token amount regardless. But one will be held accountable for the full effects of such sinful entities. No wonder you see so much deviation in Kali Yuga, so much danger. If people are entering into this contract without love, the guru is accepting and not based on love and real genuine care, then there's going to be big problems. If the disciple is not having sufficient love for his guru, then he will just do what he or she wants to do based on that sin and just think to hell with whatever the effects are. I want to do this and I'm going to do it. And therefore, Krishna will make the disciple as well as the guru have to pay for such. Some disciples are like, they get to a point, I just want to be sinful. I want to do this, do that. And they go out and do sinful activities and not realize the consequences, or they're not chanting the holy name. They're making these different aparads, and therefore it's like they are giving poison or stabbing their guru in the back. And therefore Krishna is disturbed. He makes the disciples suffer because the guru has pledged allegiance to coming for that soul, and the spiritual master has to suffer also. And then the last paragraph here, when we end, Haridas says, "My dear Lord, you are very merciful to Jagai and Marai. These brothers were born in a brahminical family, but they became known as the worst probates in Navadvip due to their violent acts. Their original names were Jagananda and Madhavananda. First you invoked a Shraddha in them, and then you gave them the holy name. O Lord, your character and activities are exemplary. They shine like beacons across the world, and everyone follows their wonderful example." So here he's just showing that even one can take the most sinful type of person as a disciple, but not if you haven't instilled faith within them before accepting them as a disciple. So Jagai and Marai, they were so sinful. And Lord Nityananda, Lord Chaitanya, they gave them benediction and blessed them and initiation. However, they changed their consciousness first. They did not just accept them. Let us become famous that we've made these debauchees our disciples. But let us use them for showing how even one can be so low and they can be helped and transformed. And this will help in the preaching like anything. So they change their consciousness by allowing them to have some basic faith, and therefore they were able to change their activities. So many things come down to Shraddha, to faith. Dridha, Brataha. We want to have determined, strong faith, but faith is not something you can pretend on. If your faith is weak, then you will repress and not transform. Your faith is weak, you will not have the necessity, feel the necessity to act in the proper way. Your faith is weak, then your desires, the sense of gratification, will be strong. Stronger than your desires for accelerating spiritually. Your faith is weak, then you will not even mind so much the contamination that one does when they assault the Vaishnavas, the sadhus, when they assault the spiritual master. They will just feel, I can't do this, I'm too weak, I don't have the desire. I want to do something else. And they try to forget what the consequences are. And so Haridasa, of course, says, such a deceitful type of disciple should eventually be rejected, and such guru who honors such is a counterfeit. And so it's a way of keeping the spiritual master accountable and responsible for what he is representing and how he's supposed to help others. And it is a way, simultaneously, of putting tax on the disciple. The disciple realizes what their position is and what their responsibilities are. And so what we talked about today is we were looking first at what is sin versus offense, and explaining that offense is actually even greater. Because offense is like when the sin has become so much a part of one's existence that one is doing the sin continuously while involving themselves in the spiritual process. Now it's turning into aparad, where there is knowledge, but still one is so much attached to the deviant activity, they continue. We also looked at the fact that one should not preach to the faithless, Although we hear you're supposed to preach every town, every village. But it means, in general, when somebody is offensive and you're trying to approach them, trying to share the holy name is not going to help them. They're just going to become more offensive. We try to give everybody an opportunity, either within the Gaudi community or outside, but if they're not taking advantage of it, then there must be some shift of relationship and of activity. Somebody's blaspheming? Okay. By still trying to give them Krishna consciousness, they are incurring more aparads, they're offending the message, the messenger, and so you do not impose Krishna consciousness on them. Someone is coming into devotional service, they may come from all kind of backgrounds, have all kind of issues and attachments, but if we can't somehow get them to have basic faith, then there's no question that they should not be given initiation. Now the danger is, sometimes they appear to have faith, or they're okay at first, and then later they become deviant. That's why some of us may give initiation rather quick, because we realize a person can even perform very nicely for 3, 4, 5 years. 6, 7, 8 years later, become, you know, a big deviant. So even though they may do good for 2 or 3 years, there's no sign that that person is going to be consistent some years later. So there's always a risk that's involved. But now when the person does become deviant, then we must try many ways to help. If at some point the person does not change, then there should just be a rejection so that they don't both go to hell, or so that they're not sanctioning such thing that can bring confusion to those who are trying to be more serious. And so he ends with stressing how in the case of Jagai and Marai were extremely sinful, that a risk was taken. Compassion was there to try to help them, but they were given some initial faith, and then they remained faithful to their contract, and they got all the benefits therein. But in cases where people choose to deviate, there's consequences on all sides. And we conclude that that is just natural, because in basic societal existence, we do something wrong, there's consequences. You got a job, you do something wrong, you get called out on it, you continue, you get sacked, or you get wages taken away, or you get some type of demotion. If you make a sin, a crime, so you may get off for some time, or just be probation, you continue the crime, you have to do time, you do it more, it's more serious of what you have to be dealt with, of how you are dealt with. You may have done something based on accidental arrangements out of passion. It's still considered an offense, a crime. You broke the law, but it's not the same as if you planned. You are in a premeditated state and you do it, it's considered to be much more serious. So why not in spiritual life? We know what is proper and we plan to do sense gratification. Why should the Lord let us off so easily of the hook? It should be considered a very grave affair, and it is. Hare Krishna. Any questions or comments?
Maharaj, how can a devotee discriminate between experiencing an accidental fall down and committing this offense of sinning on the strength of the holy name when it seems that some or many of the people guilty of this offense won't consciously say to themselves, I'm going to sin and then I'm going to chant extra rounds or I'm going to do this and do that? So how can they tell whether or not they're guilty of this offense?
First thing is to be tremendously afraid of any type of deviation. To be tremendously afraid of Maya, so that one will not become so close to Maya where there is more chance for some type of fall. So we have great, great fear. It's like Haridasa Thakur himself was in the mindset that if I don't finish all my rounds, I'll fall into Maya, even though he didn't even have to chant. Or the Prabhupada once said how when he comes and sees the deities and offers his prayers before the deities, he is praying not to fall. It's helping us to understand that as long as we are very fearful of Maya, there will not be a fall. And if there is some slight deviation, we'll merely be able to bounce back. But it's when we start taking Maya for granted and we just consider, well, big deal. I didn't chant today, big deal. I took those, drugs, Not a big deal. That's all. Most of the time I'm doing okay. Every now and then I go for a little illicit sex. All right. I did something wrong, but I'll chance some extra rounds. I'll do some fast, you know, to be freed of this. So then it becomes a sin and an offense also. So first we should just have that great fear. Now, a major indicator is, did it happen once or has it occurred several times? And if it's a reoccurrence, you can understand. This is apparat. Anyone else?
Maharaj, I want to hear your comments on when a person has not done the sankalp or has got initiation. When you get initiated, yes, all these are the offenses. He has to go through sinful because he is committed to that. But Kali Yuga, just the chanting of the name of Lord, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, that itself is always beneficial and never puts you back, no matter how you say it, how many times you japo the name. Then there's the any type of offense comes in that also, or is a straightforward ticket. Okay, you japo the name and there's no offense and no sins attached to it. Personal actions are different.
Yes. You see, until we are fully pure, there is always some traces of offenses. But the Lord is not holding that, you know, so much against us. I mean, the fact that we see the deity and we don't fully accept that it's Krishna, God, but we're chanting the holy name, and we're not fully understanding that it's not different than Krishna. The fact that we're chanting and, you know, tears not coming from our eyes and our body's trembling is a sign that there is some obfuscation, some ambiguity, some static in the process. And so that means some slight apparats are in fact there. But that is not so much held against us because this is Kali Yuga and it is a process of development. But it's when we consciously know something is wrong and we keep doing it, then that is when it is very great. It's very unfortunate. And it will weaken the person's creeper to the point that it will destroy their creeper after a while.
Yeah. When he just spoke once the name of his son as a Narayan and not even thought about the deities or Lord Krishna in any way, even he got the salvation. So how does it really...
Because, see, many of these stories, the other parts of the story. Now, what had really happened is that he, in previous time, had been a Paka Brahmana and was worshipping the Narayan as a deity. His son happened to be called also Narayan. When he called his son's name, he was also reconnecting with his previous connection, commitment, pujas with his deity Narayan. And because that had been still part of his permanent spiritual bank account, he was able to get benefits from that. But it was really associated with the fact that he had worshipped Lord Narayan very seriously at one time. And so we can understand, you know, the beauty that's there, that even if we become deviant, that there is all of these other things to be considered based on what we have done that is good. And so Krishna allowed him to, at the time of death, to be thinking about his son Narayan as that connected him with the deity Narayan, which made some alteration of his consciousness.
Person out on the street and we want to bring him into the consciousness, we want to uplift him, he's not going to right from the beginning start, and we'll have to force him or somehow convince him to say the name without realizing what he is doing. Then he's committing sinful activities too at that time?
Just like we may try to encourage someone, just say Hare Krishna. That is not an offense because you're not initiating them into the day-to-day process of chanting Hare Krishna as a Vaishnava. So we were reading earlier that someone can benefit, you know, by Ajnana Sukriti, one of the ways that a person, you know, benefits, that they are doing some devotion, they're chanting the holy name, they'll even know exactly what's going on. No, that's not an offense on that part of that person. The person will benefit because they're not just outright trying to, you know, be something and at the same time they're not that. Even if they say it in jest or in laughter or whatever, that's, you know, still they'll benefit. But it's when someone is being brought into the Parampara process and now they've made commitments and they're choosing to do sin even though they've made commitments. Yes, Adwaita.
It's a question about guru, spiritual master. What is the position of guru who, I read here, initiate the insincere pretender in a case that, let's say, he doesn't act promptly by excommunicating him?
Just like what a father does who has several children. One child, you know, becomes such a debauchee. He tries to help the child. He tries to get the other children to help the child. And then at some point, he sends the child away. What is the position? He's always thinking of that child. He's eager to help. At any time the child is ready to change, his love is still there, even though he's had to do something, you see, very abrupt, with the hopes that it would maybe help that child to come to his senses. Every now and then he sends some other brothers and sisters to try to somehow, you know, to connect with the child. He's very concerned about the well-being, the welfare, something like that.
It means, actually. Is it?
What rejection means is that, what's according to the guru, rejection could mean he's no longer holding responsibility. Just like you have insurance, so you're paying the policy, and then you stop paying the policy and you have an accident. Then you go to the insurance company, you say, I had an accident in my car, and you're looking for insurance. And they say, oh, your insurance policy is no longer valid. So it means you are no longer covered. Means like this.
Saying that we are because we can make offenses and aparads in the mind?
Yeah, in Kali Yuga, we make mental offenses. We're not held fully responsible for the mental offense, but it's still an offense.
Maharaj, you said two things. When you leave room or any time for inactivity, Maya grabs you. And repression of desires does not work. You have to transform them so that you can progress in your Krishna consciousness. Could you elaborate on these two themes, please?
Mm-hmm. That we see. When the mind is idle, it'll gradually get filled up with something. And when it's idle, it can get filled up with things that you don't really want it, you know, to be pondering upon. But that'll happen. Just like, for instance, when the mind is idle, then sometimes on all kind of past desires and things come forth, or whatever's in the environment, one becomes, you know, attached to it, or one becomes aligned or connected with it. But if the mind is active, then you're kind of directing what happens, what the mind is going to be doing, you know, what it's going to be about. And you kind of become less allured or distracted by other things. So it's like that. And in terms of repression, is that we all want happiness, security, relationship. It is an integral part. Like the class I gave at the school, I gave a class at Penn State the other day, and I was mentioning about the just different basic needs that one has as being a human. And even psychologists, they recognize certain basic needs. So if these needs are not met, we will always find some way to try to meet them. We're not having them satisfied in the spiritual community, then after a while we will go other places for it. So if I'm doing something, as Bhaktivinoda, the Course says, it's important that the mind is to be stimulated, somewhat satisfied. But if I'm just working, my mind is not satisfied, after a while, I'm going to leave and do something else. Maybe working with the cows, maybe doing treasury, or maybe doing sankirtan, or whatever. But if I'm doing that day after day after day, and I really have no appreciation, I have no taste, I have no desire to do it, then I'm doing it. I'm giving my legs and my hands, and I'm giving my arms. I'm not really giving my mind to myself. So after a while, even the legs, arms, and hands won't want to continue. And now one will start doing something else, because there was more repression of some other desires that the person was having, and they're not feeling, you know, satisfied with what they're doing. So those other unhealthy desires are just there, but they're kind of undercover. And after a while, those unhealthy desires just start coming forth again.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
My question was also, how does one transform? You gave an example of you may do some aspect of devotional service, and you may do it mechanically. The point was, how does one transform it?
There's not such a problem. Most things we do in a neophyte stage, we don't have so much realization and taste at first. But as we're constantly getting more understanding, then we begin to have less botheration, more appreciation, and then after a while we even start having taste. You see. But see, that's hard if we're not honest and if we're too selfish. If we're not honest, we'll pretend, and then there's a problem. If we're too selfish, we won't be able even to have our mind fixed that we can even try to hear and understand why something is important, why it's necessary. We'll just be thinking, I want. It's like the small child. Sometimes the mother, father says, no, Johnny, this is dangerous. This knife can cut you. No, don't do this. And the kid's crying, I want. Give it to me. And so that kind of selfishness will cause the child not to see the danger that they're embarking upon, that they're trying to connect with. They just think, I want. And so sometimes a devotee is like that, a so-called devotee. So they have something there that's unhealthy that they want. And therefore, they cannot even see other things in the proper way. So sometimes they have to experience that. Yes. See, this all may sound complicated in one extent, but it's not really so complicated. It just means we have to look closer to see, are we mainly focused based on trying to honor law? It's like, isn't that so hard for someone not to be a criminal? If they really focus on what is the laws of this company, what is the laws of society, what is expected of me, and now I just understand why it's there and I do it. It's not such a problem. But for some people, it is so hard for them to stay out of jail, stay out of fines, being fined, because they have such a mentality of corruption. And so they see something, they think, I'm going to take it. This time I'll get away. But if they don't have that kind of mentality, they don't keep getting drawn into a situation that then puts them in prison. So there's some devotees that they're so dishonest with themselves, or they have such a propensity for deviation. So they constantly get sort of drawn into that, because it's such a part of their consciousness. Some other devotees don't have it. They're the same, or never have it in that way. Some devotees who keep getting drawn somehow to intoxications again. You know, they go a couple of months, they're good, and they go back. You know, some devotees, they get such depression, Mogat Bokatyaga, and this way. Because there's a cheating propensity that's there. You can't cheat Krishna. You can't come to Krishna with cheating and be happy. So where we're unhappy and disturbed is where we're coming to Krishna and we're cheating. Because of cheating, then we get this problem and that problem. But that problem is also Krishna trying to let us know, stop cheating. And then you won't have the problem. But some then change and some don't.
You're saying that a spiritual master who has deviant disciples and doesn't reject them, Krishna will hold that spiritual master responsible. What if the spiritual master doesn't know the extent of the deviance of his disciples, doesn't know that they're deviant? Is that same full responsibility, is he still accountable for that?
Yes. Still accountable. He may not know exactly to what degree a person is being sinful, but Krishna will have a way to help him to have some basic understanding. It's like at one point, one year, I just had to kind of have a general proclamation, you know, for my disciples on the African continent, in West Africa. And after several years of disciples being deviant, I had to let them know that that you're no longer disciples. And so this was a way that some who were deviant now had a chance to see how serious it was and to try to rectify. But I made it very clear. Any of my disciples had a general situation who have been going on for several years, have been following the principles that you're no longer considered a disciple. Some then contacted me and asked for forgiveness and said they would try to do better, and they were accepted. That's it. Others, didn't, and don't take responsibility for them. There's a few of my disciples here in America. I had to send them letters and tell them, I have tried to guide you, I've counseled you, I've tried to get you all kind of help, and you keep on, in spite of that, doing something sinful, and you go on and on, it's been going on for years, you can understand that our contract is broken. Because you have broken it. Contract means two parties involved. So therefore, the fact that you have constantly chosen to do deviation means that you have broken the contract. So I'm just letting you know that I also understand you've broken the contract, and letting you know now you have freedom to do whatever you want, that you are fully held responsible yourself. We're not held to be responsible. Right? I had to do that in a few cases. A few cases I've done it, and then the person has tried to change, and I immediately accept them back. After they make apologies to Srila Prabhupada, and undergo, sometimes I've asked them to sit in again, just in general, when a yajna is going on, as they reconfirm their vows. Then I've asked him to write a letter where they are stating their apology so that they are clear on it, and then to beg the mercy of Srila Prabhupada. Because in some cases I've let them know that maybe I wouldn't personally accept you back, but because what I'm having is to offer to Prabhupada, then I'm asking you to go to Srila Prabhupada and you ask him for forgiveness, and then obviously, I will accept you back based on that. Yes.
Actually, it's two questions. I don't know if you can combine the answers. The first question has to do with past life contracts, and because we hear that term a lot. So I'm trying to understand, if we come in with a contract, and then also we have the element of free will, at what point, we've agreed to do this, this, and this, and so many sins, and suffer, at what point can that pattern be broken? How can we break that contract, if that is a valid statement? And then the second...
Let me take that first, because that's pretty intricate. Yes, before we come into this world, we ourselves have made a major decision on what our bodies will be, what gender will be, and what some immediate things we will have to experience. That's worked out with higher authorities, but it has to do with our previous desires and also the needs that we have to experience, in this particular lifetime. So we're much more responsible than we often think. Now, even though we're responsible and we come in with some baggage, some credits, some debits, still, every moment, we're making decisions. And those decisions are affecting what the future is going to be.
Okay. The second question is in regards to the statement that you, the answer that you gave, about breaking the contract with the spiritual master. So how is it when you said that,
so important. Devamrita Swami was explaining in Russia how Prabhupada was explaining in one of the conversations that it is not only that one may be thrown back to the 8,400,000 species of life, but one may have to go to every body associated with each species sometime before they even come back to the human form. So when we come to the human form, it is like really a serious time. And earlier we were reading that in the higher kingdoms, one basically just works off the benefits of their pious credits, but doesn't so normally go back to the spiritual kingdom, because that body isn't fit for it. So there's something really, really special about the human body that you can go, you can finish it up now. And so in the lower bodies, it says too much suffering, and even in the heavenly kingdom bodies, I was shocked at the emphasis that Haridas put on. He says that basically one doesn't go back to Godhead from the heavenly kingdoms. I always considered that many will go, that most maybe not because they get too preoccupied, but he said the general mood is that you don't go back. Because you're just kind of enjoying, it's like in a vacation. You're enjoying the benefits of the vacation, and then after it's over, then you go to work. She said the heavenly kingdoms are more like enjoying the vacation benefits. So usually a person doesn't go back. So that means when we come to the human body, it is like so special that if we don't take advantage of it, then it can be, thousands, thousands of lifetimes before we even get a chance again. Then we begin to see again how rare it really is when somehow we've come in touch with Guru, with the Parampara system, and to be able to take advantage of it, of such. So we'll stop there. And so read the next two chapters, tomorrow. We also have a guest coming. Tomorrow is Saturday. So Shruti Kirti will be coming for Saturday and Sunday. He was one of Prabhupada's servants. It's like Hari Sari. It's a special benediction for us. Please take full advantage and listening to his classes and asking him questions. He had so many years of direct association with Srila Prabhupada in a very intimate way. So he will give a course for 2 days. His course will be in the evening, I think. That's worked out. Tivedanta Swami Tirabhupaki. Sisi Radha Damodara Jiki.